Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, it's episode 444. I'm happy to bring you the preview of the October 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician is a for-free in-print and online publication. You can find that at retinalphysician.com. This month's issue focused on anti-VEGF therapy and clinical trials, as well as a brief note about ROP and anti-VEGF therapy. I was really happy to be joined by Drs. Safa Rahmani and Priya Vakaria for this episode. I apologize for my voice, dealing with a little cold slash laryngitis, which is why this episode was a little bit delayed, but we have a great slate of episodes here in October coming up. As we head towards our 8-year anniversary, it's hard to believe our first episode came up on November 2nd, 2016. As we approach 8 years, as we approach 450 episodes, again, thank you to all of you who have listened, who have continued to be loyal and, you know, and continue to be, to inspire us to keep doing what we do. You know, this is just an aside and not going to be as relevant to that many people listening here. But as many of you know, I listen to many podcasts outside of medicine. That's what inspired me to start this podcast in the first place 8 years ago. One of my favorite podcasters, again, probably not relevant to many of you, is Zach Lowe. Zach Lowe is a journalist who originally trained in crime journalism and then became a basketball podcaster and writer. And he's, in my mind, one of the best, if not the best, basketball writer or podcaster of my lifetime. Zach Lowe was recently let go by ESPN. And, you know, these things happen. These things are cyclical. They bring up questions about what is truly valued, what is meaningful. The things that were valued about someone like him that would speak to anyone who's listening, not just people who like basketball, was that he was fair. He was very, very honest in his appraisals. He was entertaining, but he was also knowledgeable. He took time to read and to think and to talk to the right people rather than just spout off opinions that would get more hits or get people to tune in. He was not a take master. He was not somebody who was looking for the clicks. And I admired that in him, even as someone who's never met him, just from afar. And, you know, I'm not saying we've met that standard, but I just did want to mention Zach Lowe because even though this is a retina podcast and that was a basketball podcast, when we started this, I tried to emulate some of his style. And when we talk about retina, when we talk about papers, maybe with a little more spice sometimes, depending on, I can be a little opinionated on certain topics, but just to try to be as fair as possible and to also try to take things that are complicated and break them down in a simple fashion so that if you're listening or multitasking, you can still follow. So anyway, shout out to Zach Lowe. And one other final basketball shout out, Dikembe Mutombo, again, a name not familiar to people who don't follow basketball, was a 58-year-old former basketball player who passed from brain cancer, but really known as a humanitarian. And even if he had not made it as a basketball player, was a tremendous humanitarian building schools in the Congo, his native country, and changing the world. And it was remarkable, again, in context for all of us as physicians, just hearing all the stories about what he achieved and the impact he had and the type of personality he was and the energy he brought. And, you know, we all can have that impact. You know, we don't all have to be multi-million-dollar basketball players to build hospitals to make an impact. We make that impact every day with the colleagues we work with, the students and residents and fellows we mentor, with the patients we take care of, and really just the people in your community you see on a daily basis and inspire. So those were things, you know, again, take lessons from a sad event and just hearing some of the stories to try to always try to be better. And hopefully you enjoy this episode and the rest of the month. If I see some of you at Academy, great to catch up in the brief time we're all there, and hopefully you enjoy the rest of this episode. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the preview of the October 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online and in print for free at retinalphysician.com. As a reminder, the articles we covered today, they're all available. You can go read them. We're not here to exhaustively cover them. We're going to use them as jumping off points for discussion. I'll hit the major points and then discuss with two of my favorite retina colleagues from around the country. Joining for today's episode, first in Chicago, Illinois, in alphabetical order, Dr. Safa Rahmani. Safa, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Priya Vakaria is in Tampa, Florida. Priya, welcome back. Hope you and yours are safe with the recent storm that passed through.
Thank you for having me, Jay. And yeah, we're all good. Thank you for asking.
Thoughts go out to our retina colleagues, their patients, anyone, you know, big impact in the storm. I have a lot of friends from medical school kind of living in that southeast region that got hit hard. So hopefully they can get power and other utilities up soon. We're going to cover three articles today. The theme for this retinal physician was wet AMD and anti-VEGF therapy, which obviously we spend a lot of time talking about in the retina space, but it doesn't become redundant because there's always new things to discuss. And the first article I want to hit on is Ruan Silva. Ruan Silva wrote this article. He was actually my senior resident at Bascom Palmer. He's currently at Stanford. And this is a really well-written and interesting article about, he called it, the evolution of clinical trial endpoints for wet AMD, the subtitle, as new treatments are introduced. The endpoints that drive regulatory approvals are constantly changing. And he talks a little bit, as we go through the articles, the major points would be sort of, what are endpoints for a trial, right? There's always a primary endpoint, a secondary endpoint, and why do secondary endpoints exist? Usually it's supposed to be supportive, right? And it makes sense. If you're going to spend a lot of money and a lot of effort and resources, why have a single endpoint? Try to data mine as much as you can. And then, of course, there's always tertiary endpoints and post-hoc analyses. He then goes into a little bit of the history of the original trials, right? They were initially not pharmacologic trials. It was PDT, verdiporfin trials. And the endpoints from those are interesting to look back on. You know, they talked about the endpoint, obviously, of visual acuity was best corrected change, which has been set up now for 30, 40 years, talks about TAP and VIP and these trials that we learned about in our BCSC in the early 2010s that no resident learns about now because it's not really relevant to clinical practice. But one thing he does mention that's interesting was it started shifting to how many patients didn't lose X amount of vision versus pure visual acuity outcomes. For example, they talked about for Macugen, the phase 3 trial, they looked at what percent of patients lost less than 15 letters, which is less than 3 lines. Because again, the bar was not to lose vision rather than visual gain. And then Marina and Anchor really heralded in this era of, okay, what's the visual acuity result? And they showed, for example, 40% or more of these patients had visual acuity improved by 15 letters or more versus 5.6% in the PDT arm. But then he transitions, and this is the part we're going to talk a lot about, is things have shifted now to extension and non-inferiority, right? Because we hit such a home run with anti-VEGF in terms of efficacy, then we started having to talk about, well, it's just something isn't worse than standard of care because it was becoming clear that it was going to be very difficult. And a part of the thing he points out is you had to use active controls at some point. You couldn't do sham as your control anymore because it was unethical. You'd be withholding treatment from patients who should be getting anti-VEGF. And so all the newer generations of drug would say, hey, it's got to be with X and non-inferiority margin. And this is interesting. Like, how do you design that control arm? Well, you try to say justify by saying, well, we use the same sort of dosing for the control arm as a previous trial or the FDA approved dosing or things like that. CAT is a great example of a non-inferiority trial looking at bevacizumab and ranibizumab arms. But then the final thing, the last kind of section talks about durability, right? And this came up with faricimab when we talk about phase 2 Avenue Stairway, phase 3 Tenaya Lucerne for wet AMD, Yosemite and Ryan for DME. And now we talk about things that are in trial, Regenx Bio, RGX and Ascent, talking about non-inferiority, things such as other gene therapy that we're going to talk about, like NDMT. We have other sort of comparisons now, and everything, and I'll start with USOP, has shifted towards non-inferiority. I like this article a lot because it gets you thinking about the goalposts. The goalposts are shifting, and sometimes that's used as a criticism, saying that we shift the goalposts in order to make it convenient, right? We say, okay, we want our drug to be approved, and we want X drug to succeed, so we shift the goalposts. But in reality, the goalposts have to shift because of ethics and because of the times. It would make no sense for the goalposts of 2024 retina care to match the goalposts of 1994 retina care. And so it makes sense for the control arm to shift, and it also makes sense to say, what are the goals of this new agent? I just want your thoughts overall on this. I mean, we've talked about durability before. I mean, to what extent is the shift in the goalposts appropriate? So, for example, you're someone who's an academic institution. You're doing a journal club with your fellows or your residents. One of the things you look at is, what were they looking for in the trial? Was it reasonably designed? Because a lot of times the criticism that comes up is, well, industry-sponsored trial, they're going to sort of slant it so that their drug can succeed. Because if you don't hit your primary endpoint, generally you don't get your drug approved outside of GA and dry AMD, which you can talk about in a second.
No, this was a really well written article that just kind of summarized a lot, like where basically the story of what we've come from, you know. And as you said, because we now have such overwhelmingly positive, you know, treatments, these nuances become more and more important because now we talk about the treatment burden, the number of times patients have to come in, the comfort of the patients every time they get these, you know, injections. All these, because we have such great treatment, all these nuances become more and more important. And the article kind of mentions that, you know, we go with the regulators, we go with the clinicians, we go with the patients. And it becomes more and more important to navigate what are we trying to accomplish. And yes, you know, I think you always have to look at industry-sponsored trials, you know, with a little bit more carefully because what are they trying to achieve? But if it wasn't for these trials pushing through, I think we wouldn't be as innovative, you know. And I think the innovation, you know, there's multiple kind of ways that you can look at innovation, and I feel like these trials really push what we can do forward. And it's important to really consider, okay, now the goal is to push out and to decrease how often we bring these patients because we have reached such a good, you know, sort of vision-saving therapies. I think these are really important. And I think it, as the population ages and as we're not keeping up with the treatment burden, that's for sure. So I think it's really important to talk about these and bring it forward.
Priya, Safa made some really good points, and you're in a practice, and you know, you work with David Eschenbaum, who's someone who, you know, you guys do a lot of trials, and so companies may approach you at some point about the design of a trial and how it's designed, and you may ask questions. You know, one thing that occurs to me, you know, best corrected visual acuity, it's going to be very hard. We all know those curves from the phase three trials. They essentially look all the same. Their letter might be different, but if you look at Marina Anchor, you look at Rise and Ride, you look at Vivid and Vista, you look at View, and then you go to the modern trials, you look at Photon, Pulsar, Yosemite, Rhine, Tenaya, Lucerne, the curves all are essentially the same. So it makes sense at some point to say you're not gonna, not that you can't, but you're probably not gonna aim for superiority there because maybe you've hit a ceiling effect. And more importantly, again, there's a practical aspect is that if you want this treatment available, you have to show to payers and you have to show to the FDA. You have to show, okay, like why are we gonna approve X new expensive drug? What is the benefit to patients and providers? But I'm curious about like, do you think we'll shift from non-inferiority to something else at some point? Because a lot of the new trials, they'll show secondary data, secondary endpoint, or a post-hoc analysis and say, look, we're still not perfect with the old drugs. We might hit a visual acuity ceiling, but we're not hitting a ceiling, for example, in terms of being fluid-free. So there's a lot of these trials, they say, hey, you look at the fluid-free percentage at a year, it's only like 60%. And maybe that's not the most important thing, right? If someone has a little cyst of fluid here or there, but there seems to be some meat on the bone there where you could argue that, hey, our drug gets you fluid-free 80% versus 60% or 90% versus 60%. And yet I don't know if that would happen. I mean, when you talk to people, do you think an endpoint beyond non-inferiority will ever in our, let's say 5, 10, 15 years shift? Or if it's not fluid, what would you think would be another endpoint? Because again, it's a more nebulous endpoint to say time between injections, for example, which is essentially what we're demonstrating, but it's a lot harder to make that your primary endpoint from a statistical standpoint.
I mean, I think we'll definitely. So I think it's hard to prove superiority to current standard of care because current standard of care is really good. And that's why everyone's focused on durability and duration. But there are trials out there that are currently looking at superiority. So, for example, Opthea's COAST study is trying to prove superiority because I think what they're trying to do is, you know, in year two, you start getting a slight decline in visual acuity in these trials. And they're trying to kind of show that their drug, that's kind of their niche. They want to show that their drug, in addition to aflibercept or ranibizumab, will achieve superiority. So we are going to see some superiority trials out there. You know, it's not to say that superiority doesn't exist. And then also remember, the FDA is starting to change some of their non-inferiority parameters and trials against these sham injections. And so that's also affecting it, right? Because if you really want to do a non-inferiority study, sometimes it needs to be a lot bigger. And that's kind of something that Ocular Therapeutics has run into. And so they're kind of doing a study with just, you know, two arms with rescue injections in both arms. And so there's weird things that are happening, not only from the FDA, you know, so that's kind of influencing some of our trial designs. But yeah, I mean, we can see superiority studies for sure. I think, and I want to believe, you know, I want to be that optimistic person that believes we can still be better than the current standard of care, but it is really hard to achieve that.
It's also hard, we should mention, because the visual acuity entry, right, can range from usually from like 20/30 to 20/30 to 20/200. And if you're going simply by lines gained or letters gained, because we're getting patients earlier, you don't have as much margin or as room to get that increase, right? So like you're sort of sealing off there because the chart is only so big. It's not like you go from being 20/40 to 20/10. Versus probably if you go back, and I'd be curious to look at the visions. I don't know off the top of my head when you go back to the original anti-VEGF trials, probably you're getting to a lot of these patients a lot later than we're getting to when you enroll them in these trials. So let's transition to talking about trial design in the context of tyrosine kinase. So Carl Regillo wrote this article called Innovative Wet AMD Therapy Shows Promising Results. And this, again, the subtitle, Sustained Release Vorolanib Intravitreal Insert Has Shown Potential in Phase 2 Trials. Further evaluation will occur in the upcoming trials of Lugano and Lucia. And just like everything Carl Regillo does, he essentially summarized the article, so I don't know if there's much for me to add here. But essentially, EyePoint is doing these trials with DuraView or EYP-1901, which is a tyrosine kinase intravitreal insert that's injected that's supposed to give at least 6 months of drug. So think of it as sort of souped up Ozurdex kind of delivery system, right? The nice thing about it is it's interesting. It doesn't have to be refrigerated, which I think is nice to file away. I'd be curious if that holds true once it hits the market, but that's just a little side note that I highlighted when I was reading this article. And the DAVIO 2 trial was the phase 2 trial looking at how to dose this versus aflibercept. And if you look at the trial design for that trial, the control arm, again, going back to what we talked about, was aflibercept, and you were given sort of monthly loading doses initially. You've got the 3 loading doses, and then you were Q8 after that. And then in terms of DuraView, you were given, again, loading doses at the beginning. If you got DuraView, you also got a aflibercept for those 3 monthly injections. And then the question was, how often do you get treated? You don't get retreated. In fact, you get sham injections. So the idea here is you still get a aflibercept up front, but then does the DuraView allow you to get that extension where you don't need rescue, right? So the patients aren't getting re-injected as a scheduled injection. They would have to meet criteria. And again, we always look at the criteria. I mean, the criteria were, hey, you had to lose a line of vision, 75 micron increase, which is a little larger than some of the other trials. Some have ranged from 25 to 50 micron increase in CST. And then it's the and or it, so again, it was either that 5 letters and 75 microns or 100 microns or hemorrhage or a 10 letter reduction. So some can argue that maybe it's not as strict as what we do in practice, but its primary endpoint again was the mean change in visual acuity, looking for that non-inferiority, and they hit non-inferiority. Looking at the retreatment and the treatment burden, 89% and 85% reduction in the 2 DuraView arms relative to the control arms. And so, again, there is no real incidence. They're doing a phase 3 trial, Lugano and Lucia. Very, very similar. You're going to get loading doses with the aflibercept in both arms. There's a single arm for DuraView this time, single arm for aflibercept. And then after that, scheduled injections with the aflibercept Q8, and then scheduled DuraView in the DuraView arms every 24 weeks or so. So taking you out to 6 months, and then you can be rescued, of course. So Priya, I'll circle back. I mean, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about. Interestingly enough, the visual acuity, again, because people want to enroll in trials, your visual acuity is very all-encompassing. 35 to 78 letters, there's just some patients with really good vision, which goes back to our point about difficulties in showing superiority. And again, primary objective, non-inferiority at baseline to weeks 52 and 56 average. And of course, secondary endpoints, always CST, treatment burden reduction, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, anything interesting about this trial design that stood out to you? I think it's always interesting. It's going to be a whole total paradigm shift for us. We're, again, in a situation where you're going to meet a patient, you're going to say, okay, we're going to start you with anti-VEGF injections, but you're also going to get this injection that has X percent chance of extending out your treatments. I'd be curious, like when we get to clinical practice, assuming that the drugs are not bundled together in a single syringe or vial, when would a retina specialist go to this, right? I mean, payers, how is that going to work from a payment standpoint? Even besides payment, I mean, most of us, I think, I imagine a lot of retina specialists will say, well, I'll add it if I feel I need it later. That's not the trial design, though, and those wouldn't be the patients you chose out. So it's always interesting because this is like when new drugs like faricimab or Eylea HD came out. People said, well, you're not doing it the trial way because you're not reloading all your patients. This is, well, the patients I want to switch aren't the patients who want to go back to loading every month. They're the patients who want to extend. I'm just curious what you think about trial design. And then if it does go to market, what do you think that will look like?
You know, I think the trial design, I think it makes sense, right? You know, these, you're comparing to an active aflibercept control arm that gets it every 8 weeks, which is nice, you know, that we're kind of used to seeing that as a comparator arm. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, the goal here of this trial is to basically see if DuraView can decrease treatment burden. You know, we're assuming that it'll meet non-inferiority in terms of visual acuity. That's never a given. That's obviously the most important thing. But then the assumption would be it's going to reduce treatment burden, and by how much. You know, I think your second question is, if this comes to market, how will retina specialists use it? And I think this inherently makes sense, right? If you think about diabetics and insulin, they get long-acting insulin, and then they get boluses of insulin throughout when they need it in terms of sugars. And, you know, if you think about the retina, you could think about a tyrosine kinase inhibitor as like a longer lasting basal level of control. Obviously, patients may still need rescues throughout that. And so I think that inherently this makes sense, not as one of those therapies for these recalcitrant patients, but as a combination or an additional therapy. And I think in that way, retina specialists are actually, I feel like, will adopt it, right? Because the sell here, as far as I can understand, based on the trial and based on what these companies are talking about, is not to replace our anti-VEGFs, but to be an additive agent to help with better control and decrease treatment burden. And that makes sense to me. And I think that, you know, as with all drugs, we're not going to use it for a little while the way it's intended, as people are trying to figure it out. And then if it gets FDA approval, perhaps it will be an early treatment in our arsenal. We'll have to see.
Safa, again, this is a little outside of this, but I'm always curious, why do you think, like, what would you do? Like, what do you, Priya brought up, I mean, we don't know what this would look like. I think it's always interesting, because the only example I think of combo treatment is steroid plus anti-VEGF. That was the classic thing that Alimera, which is sold at ANI, was talking about with Iluvien. That's what Allergan's talked about. Ozurdex is like, well, use it in your combo patients, right? And combo therapy, there are people who do it. I'm not saying, if you're someone's listening, like, well, I do combo therapy, all power to you. I'm just saying, when you do surveys, most retina specialists do not do combo therapy. Whether that's because it's more complicated from a payer standpoint, or it's just you don't want to do more injections, or the patients don't want to, it just doesn't happen. Like, what do you think would be different here that would convince people to do combo therapy? Because the interesting part of the trial design would be, why wouldn't you just stack up your injection, just like in PDS or Regenix, a 1-to-1 against anti-VEGF? Why is it anti-VEGF plus? And I guess the argument would be, again, anti-VEGF is so effective. It's not, maybe it's just not, tyrosine kinase on its own is just not effective enough to make it ethical to withhold anti-VEGF therapy. But you easily could have dropped, from a scientific perspective, you could have designed a trial where you gave it and then you had rescue and you rescued the patients. But maybe they knew it wouldn't perform as well. I'm not going after EyePoint. I'm just talking about this class in general. What do you think? Is it just going to be our recalcitrant patients where you're like, okay, well, I'm going to keep you on anti-VEGF and add this? I mean, that really puts a ceiling, again, speaking of ceiling effects, on how much effect and impact on the market the drug will have. And really, on our standpoint, clinicians, how much of an impact is going to have in our daily practice? Like, because again, is it going to be something like a steroid where it's like 5% of your practice, or is it going to be something like an anti-VEGF where it's 80, 90, 95% of your practice?
Yeah, those are all such good points. I think a really strong point that this could potentially have is the, as Priya said, is the longevity. You know, as the trial goes on and on, I think the longevity of how long this can push, you know, people out in terms of needing rescue is really going to be important. And I do agree. I think with all the new agents that come, because our previous agents were so good, most people started the new agents on their recalcitrant, difficult to control patients. It's just, that's what you're able to sell the new medicines much better. You know, this is, it's just easier conversation with patients. Like, hey, we've tried this monthly for 2 years. It's not working. Are you willing to try this new drug that has this side effect profile, whatever it is? So I do think that even if this pans out, there will be a shift that we will start with all the recalcitrant patients first, and all the difficult to control. Maybe they're difficult to get to clinic, variety of reasons why they're not able to stick to whatever regimen that we want. And then slowly it could potentially, you know, transition to, you know, starting this as first line. But I think from a practical point of view, I think it's very difficult to start as first line with these new agents. And that's why the trial designs don't really start as fresh because they know people are not willing to take that risk from the beginning, even if the trial is perfect, which no trial is. Even if the trial is perfect, you're not willing to, you know, when you're face to face with these patients, you're not willing to take that risk. So I think all these trials that are pushing out durability and sustainability will start with something that everybody's familiar with, like we are familiar with, you know, aflibercept. So, but I do look forward to potentially this, you know, becoming, if it pans out, becoming the standard that we could start, but it will not be at the beginning. It will not be.
The last article is not related to any of this. This is Safa's favorite topic, which is anti-VEGF therapy for ROP. And that doesn't mean we have to drop this topic. I mean, this is a very big shift in topic, but we can mention more about the idea of more therapies. At least this is a drug that won't be in our fridge, hopefully. I don't want to fix it on that point, but I know, for example, like Genentech's gotten a lot of pushback from clinicians anecdotally because, for example, they're packaging the prefilled syringe for Vabysmo with the filter needle comes separate, it takes up space. Some people don't have that big a fridge, which is a practical concern. That won't be a concern with DuraView, which is kind of nice. Or if you're going to a satellite, you don't have to leave it out there and worry that the fridge goes out and the power outage, that you're going to lose all your drug. But we'll be very interested to see. This last one on ROP was written by Vernon Volante, Lauren Kirikosa, and Hongwin Hua from Bascom Palmer. Really good review again. And we've talked about ROP before, Safa. I feel like you're my ROP retinal physician, ROP guru. Not to discount my impact or Priya's impact, but we are combined probably less knowledgeable about ROP than you are. So Priya's contributing most of that, not me. I'm going to summarize. They just go through the trials for the different drugs. Bevacizumab, BeatRop, Mirandabizumab, the Rainbow trial, and then aflibercept, again, Firefly, which I believe you were involved in that trial at some point, right? In the aflibercept trial.
Yes.
And then biosimilars, which are there as well. I mean, I feel, Safa, you're still obviously in the camp. I remember when we were talking about VBS programming, we were talking about pro-con, laser, anti-VEGF. We almost assigned you anti-VEGF, and then Yoshi Onokawa was like, no, she's going to be strongly laser camp. So I know maybe I'm burying the lead here by asking you, but I do think if you look at practice, and you may know this data better, if you look at patterns, if you talk to people treating ROP, I feel it's becoming more and more common to manage with injections, at least temporized. And it makes sense, especially in areas where you don't have someone who's really skilled at doing laser, but they may know how to do an injection and screen, or they may send you remotely a photo, but they don't know how to do the laser and the patient can't come because they're sick. They can do an injection. There are advantages to it because maybe the skill level to do it is not as high as having to do a very good laser, because as one of my mentors told me, there's either good ROP laser or there's no ROP laser. There's not really an in-between. So one of the questions, I mean, you have a finger on the pulse of the pediatric field. Like, do people feel there are differences between the drugs? Does it matter? And the reason it's going to come up is because obviously if a clinician says it doesn't matter, then a payer is listening or someone's going to say, well, then we should just pick the cheapest option and move on, because it costs the system more. We've fought that for adults. You know, we've fought that battle and said, no, biosimilars, we're not sure about the long-term impact. Hey, off-label bevacizumab may not be as good, may not be as durable, may not actually save money in certain situations. Step therapy, maybe not worth it. But what about for babies? Like, what are your thoughts on ROP? Does it matter?
I think that you've basically pointed all the things. The answer is not clear. It's not yet known. I think the first thing that the ROP world really struggled with was the systemic side effects of anti-VEGF. You know, and as more and more data come out, you know, it's more and more reassuring that we're not doing harm to these babies long-term by giving them anti-VEGF. So I think that was a huge hurdle that over the past, I would say, 5 years or so, now that these studies are more than 10 years out, we feel a little bit more confident with. So that is a really big hurdle. Then the second hurdle is really the efficacy. And I think there were some issues with some of these trials that kind of made it, you know, we wondered whether anti-VEGF is actually doing better, or because especially like for bevacizumab, their studies, the laser therapy was exceptionally low in terms of efficacy. And, you know, there's a lot of questions about, well, why is that? Who's doing the lasers? What's happening? Butterfly and Firefly, not as much. There is a kind of a discussion in terms of what are the doses and where are we going to go with this. And PDIG actually did a bunch of studies and are continuing to do it in terms of what doses can we use for all these anti-VEGFs that are available. And the answer is still not known. But I can tell you from a practical perspective, you know, there is a ceiling of not being efficacious with anti-VEGF. And I do worry that you can actually not treat ROP effectively if we're going too low. And I think a lot of the pediatric retina specialists that deal with the aftermath of the anti-VEGF not working have seen that. So I do think that there's a limit that has gone too low. But I think the final verdict is to be seen. I do think that anti-VEGF is a lot in many areas more of standard of care now, just because of all the practical things that you said. I think it has helped significantly in terms of triaging a lot of the care that would have not happened otherwise. So I do think that's a great thing. In my hands, so many babies are born. You know, our NICUs are so much better at keeping these babies alive. So we do have a lot more sicker kids that are just not stable enough to, you know, go for, you know, an hour long or 2 hour long laser, but they are stable enough for injections. So we buy time, and, you know, retina real estate a lot of times with giving injections and kind of getting the kids through some of the more difficult ROP. So I'm excited that this is all here. I think it's a good thing. But there's a lot of unanswered questions. I think with the biosimilars, it's not here yet, but it will. But I think from the ROP world, we still have a lot of unanswered questions with the agents that we have. So I don't think that US is going to take biosimilars quite yet. I think we still have a lot of unanswered questions. And because bevacizumab is readily available, the, you know, sort of the cost effectiveness is not really going to come into play quite yet.
Safa, can I ask you, when you inject a patient with anti-VEGF, an ROP patient, what are your thoughts on follow-up, you know, and following these patients? Because that can be challenging, right? When these young babies, you know, maybe the families don't realize how important it is to follow up. What are your thoughts on that?
So we, in our institution and a lot of the main big children's hospitals, we tell them, you know, we have to follow you just like every other sort of laser patient. You have to have follow-up for many months out until we're sure that things are, they don't reactivate. I follow these kids pretty regularly until they're at least 60 weeks out. And we laser pretty much everybody because all kids have some avascular retina that, we need to treat. That I think is a little bit different than some of the other private practices that just don't have the option. A lot of private practices do sort of work with pediatric ophthalmologists and other sort of groups to keep the kids in the system, but it is difficult. So I'm hoping that gets better as time goes, but I follow them just as though they have ROP. We don't say one and off. There are a subset of patients, no matter what agent you use, that will need either repeat injection or laser pretty frequently. We don't say one and done. But I think once you make it to 60 to 80 weeks, so about 6 to 8 months, you really know which way it's going to go. It's either going to remain quiet, you can laser and be done, or you'll intervene way before that.
Last thing before we go, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but so why is it okay for a premature infant to get anti-VEGF, but pregnant women can't get access to anti-VEGF?
What a great question.
I mean, obviously it's not created equal. And I mean, we just went through pregnancy and this is the sort of question you ask yourself as a parent, right? Okay, it's our baby. What would we do? But my wife's a retina specialist, and if she had a CNVM or she had DME or she had an RVO, I mean, it's really hard because I've shifted because I was taught, we were all taught, like, don't do it, stay away, medical legal, it's not worth it, you don't know what the impact on the baby is, statute of limitations, blah, blah, blah. But, like, it's so interesting because that's all just defined by what the field and community decides. No one is going to come after you medical legally for injecting a preemie baby because people have done it and they published on it and there's trials and they were fine. And so no one feels scared of doing it. But what's the difference between a 26-week premature infant and a woman who's 26 weeks pregnant?
I have a lot of strong feelings about that. And I agree that I feel that there they the woman should be given the opportunity and the information to get anti-VEGF, especially, you know, ranibizumab and those that is very minimally systemically absorbed, because I do think out of fear we withhold a lot of good treatments for pregnant women. I may be an outlier, but I've reviewed as much as out there in literature. We're never going to have a randomized clinical trial on this. We're never going to have a prospective trial on this because of the risks. So you have to see whether anything can be a surrogate. And I think ROP data is a really good surrogate for treating pregnant ladies in, you know, at least in the third trimester. Like, give the patient the autonomy to make that choice. And there are patients who are very risk averse and will say no. And there are patients who will, you know, look at the data and what you present them and may choose differently. And a lot of times we don't even have that discussion. We don't even allow the patient to have those, you know, options. And I think in
or,
this
or
age,
you phrase it in such a way that the mom would never pick not. It, right? If you're like, well, you could do this thing and you will deform your child, or you could protect your vision. Every mom is going to be like, I'll take the poor vision. Poor I don't vision, want to absolutely. Do anything for my baby.
And I think for the, or at least with the ROP data, you know, I feel that there's enough to at least have the conversation with the pregnant patient. I'm not saying staring them that way. I think we should just at least have the conversation. I think the medications is safe enough to at least have the conversation. I'm sure you're going to get some slack from somebody who said absolutely not, but
yeah,
I'm sticking to my...
I'll just say anecdotally, I had a patient like this who was a physician, and I actually said at some point, maybe we should do anti-VEGF because they were very resistant. We did a steroid, they got better, but then they had steroid response. So I was like, look, we don't want to repeat this. Let's do anti-VEGF instead. You're far enough up and down the pregnancy. And then they're like, well, I want to check on my MFM. And their MFM was like, absolutely not. I don't think it's a good idea. And so like, that's the, then it becomes hard, right? Because you're getting into their territory. It's a high-risk pregnancy already. They have a specialist. So I didn't push. But I think it's interesting. I think there's an opportunity there. I mean, we have to decide as a community what we want first, but like, we could easily start interfacing with them to have these conversations. It's very much like, I have patients who are like, well, my doctor told me I have to get a C-section because I have lattice. And they say a vaginal delivery is going to give me a retinal detachment. And it's like, well, I mean, there's many reasons to have a C-section, but that kind of sucks to get an incision in your stomach for something that has no evidence behind it. And I mean, I don't know. I never learned anywhere in school. Have you ever heard of that? I mean, have you heard this? I've been referred patients like this before from OB.
I think it's crazy. I, as a woman who had two babies, I think a lot of times, you know, physicians and just people in general treat pregnant women as if, you know, they're so fragile and that, you know, anything is going to cause a problem in it. And it's not true. You know, there's no evidence that shows that patients who have lattice need to have a C-section to decrease RD risk. And I think some of the things that we do is out of fear. And I think that in general now as a community, you know, I know that, sorry, Jay. I know that you had mentioned that, you know, that MFM had said to kind of stay away from anti-VEGF. And I've actually found the converse. I found that a lot of OBs and MFMs are really valuing, you know, evidence-based medicine and saying, well, you know, if the pregnant mom needs this, remember, you have two patients here to take care of, and you kind of just weigh the risks and benefits of everything and make your best decision. But to come back to your question, you know, C-sections are much higher risk than vaginal delivery. And so I've never once kind of told patients that. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, you also have to take care of the pregnant woman.
Well, I appreciate both of you taking the time to talk with me. I know we ran a little over. Safa, Priya, great to talk to you. Hope to see you both soon in Chicago. Safa's going to host us
absolutely.
In her hometown. So thank you all.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Jay.
Many thanks to Drs. Rahmani and Vakaria for joining for this episode. Listeners, remember, you can find 444 episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's retinapodcast.com. We have all those episodes sorted and available for your consumption. They're archived. And remember, we're on social at retinapodcast on Twitter/X and also on Facebook. You can reach me at any point with episode ideas or requests by emailing me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by clicking on the contact us link on our website. Thanks again to our whole production team, including Drs. Justin Ma, Hui Kai, Mike Minacosta, and Angela Chang. Listeners, once again, thanks for listening. Thanks for all you do on a daily basis, taking care of patients, writing articles, inspiring conversations here on this podcast. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.